Welcome to the McCarthy Report, the podcast where I, Rich Lowry, discuss with Andy McCarthy the latest legal and national security issues. This week, what else? The Cassidy Hutchison testimony. You are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And please give this podcast to Andy McCarthy the glowing, indeed gushing, 5-star reviews they deserve on iTunes. And now, without further ado, I welcome to this very podcast, through the miracle of Zoom, none other than Andy McCarthy.
Rich, how are you?
Good, Andy. How are you?
Good. Happy July.
Same to you. I love June is a great month, but I love July and especially the 4th. So wishing you and everyone out there a happy 4th.
Amen.
And here I'm going to try to do a very professional segue. So speaking of fireworks, we had some on Capitol Hill, this emergency secret testimony, a surprise testimony, I should say, from Cassidy Hutchison, an aide to Mark Meadows. It was incredibly gripping. You've already written several pieces sussing out the meaning of it. Your big takeaway is that this is quite bad for Donald Trump, but let's back up and talk about who she is and how this testimony came about. To me, it's rather extraordinary that this, whatever she is, like 25 or 26, there's some different accounts about that, a woman in her mid-20s was at the very center of American power, having started at the White House as an intern.
Yeah, that's really amazing. I mean, I guess this is like a Washington phenomenon, Rich, but I get the impression that it was more of a thing in the Trump administration because they did have more difficulty than, you know, establishment Republican administrations filling out positions. So I guess maybe this is more likely to happen. I don't know enough about how this all works to make a good judgment on that, but you know, there were an awful lot of these young people who come right out of college, some of them while they're still in college, interning in the White House, and they end up in pretty important positions. This isn't really unheard of. I was thinking about this because I got the same impression you did, like she's awfully young for all of this. But, you know, Huma Abedin, who ended up becoming a very important, influential aide, started as an intern for Hillary Clinton when she was in college in Washington. So I get the impression that this is not is not an unusual path into places where you'd end up being very surprised that people so young and seemingly inexperienced end up in these in these positions, but it does happen, and it obviously happened here.
So she gave testimony that was apparently less explosive and less forthcoming initially in her deposition, and then switched lawyers.
Yeah. So, you know, her path to the committee is interesting to me. When we say that her testimony was less forthcoming, I think just to clarify, I haven't heard that she held back. Mm-hmm. In fact, the impression I've gotten from the coverage, and Rich, I feel like it's important to say this because I had a lot to say about this up until now, but it's important to say this. A lot of this information we have about her is from reporting.
Right.
And a lot of her testimony was, you know, firsthand observations that she said she made, which we'll get into because she's run into some trouble with that. But also, you know, a lot of the things she said were things she had heard. And sometimes, even though the story is linear, it's hard reconstructing it to remember what is it that we got from her and what is it that the committee kind of spliced into her testimony. But evidently she is someone who out of college, she went to college in Virginia. And in, I think it was 2018, when she was just getting out of college as a senior, she went to work in the White House as an intern, spent some time after that with Steve Scalise as an intern when he was the, I guess he was the whip in the House. And then she worked for a few months, it looks like, for Ted Cruz in the Senate. And then she went back to the White House. Now, according to what Liz Cheney said in introducing her, she's very well known and liked on the Hill, particularly in congressional circles. And it makes that would make sense because the position she went back to when she left Cruz and went back to the White House, the position was as a legislative liaison for the White House. And she did a good enough job that when Meadows came in, they made her the principal assistant. And I think that's more than a glorified executive assistant or administrative assistant, I should say, in the sense that, as she described it, you know, her day to day depended on what Meadows day to day was, which depended on what the president's day to day was. So some days she was in the White House doing stuff and other days she was sent to the Hill to, you know, lobby for something or other that the president wanted done. So it sounded like a very interesting job. And physically, it gave her close access to the most, you know, really the center of everything in the White House, because she's her office, as they described it, they made a point, Rich, of in the testimony of saying that the White House is much smaller than people mm-hmm. think. And her office was situated, or her desk, they kept calling it, was situated right outside Mark Meadows' office when he was chief of staff. And she described it as a few paces from Trump's office, from the Oval Office, where it would be like a 5 or 10 second walk, depending on how fast you were going. So that's where that's her relevant background. Now, evidently, the committee has been so sprawling with its subpoenas that there are a number of White House aides who wouldn't be able to retain their own lawyers. And what the reporting indicates is that in what's broadly referred to as Trump world, they've arranged for representation for a lot of these people. And her lawyer originally was this guy called Stefan Passantino, who was a White House lawyer in the Trump administration. And she went, she met with the committee. It sounds like she probably met not with the members of Congress in the committee, but investigators, which is some indication that they probably didn't realize that she was a witness of any great importance to them. And the reporting indicates that she was dissatisfied with the interview, that she felt like she had much more relevant to say.
That they
didn't ask her. Mm-hmm. And that makes you know, look, if you're since we have to, you know, we're waiting for the onslaught, which has already begun about her credibility. But it is relevant that, you know, it seems like she was anxious to tell more. So she is friendly, evidently, with a lot of people in the Trump administration, including Alyssa Farah, who was the last Trump White House communications director. So she consulted with Ms. Farah, who put her in touch, apparently, with Liz Cheney. She told Farah that she wasn't really happy with the way the interview had gone. And somewhere in the process of after she meets with Liz Cheney or around the time that she meets with Liz Cheney, she changes lawyers. And the reason I think this is relevant is she's no longer represented by the Trump world lawyer. Instead, she's represented by Jody Hunt. Now, Jody Hunt is a longtime Justice Department official who's very close to Jeff Sessions, was Jeff Sessions' chief of staff at the Justice Department when he was attorney general, and then was made chief of the criminal division, chief of the civil division, which is an important job in the Justice Department. And he left the Justice Department when Sessions got blown out of there by Trump. And he ended up being one of the lawyers who opposed Texas in that litigation in the Supreme Court about the Stop the Steal stuff. So, you know, what we can glean about where he's coming from on that, you know, who knows? But he did sometime around the time she started to meet with Cheney, she got rid of Passantino and took on Jody Hunt as her counsel. And obviously, in the course of that, she's cooperated much more fully. Evidently, she had about four depositions with the committee before they brought her out for public testimony. And when they did bring her out, Rich, on Tuesday, it was abrupt. I think the last time we spoke, the last podcast, we were talking about the two sessions of the committee that they had had last week. And at the close of the Thursday session, which was the second one, the committee said that they were now taking off for a few weeks. We wouldn't hear from them again until maybe July, you know, maybe late July. And then all of a sudden on Monday, they abruptly announced that there would be a hearing on Tuesday afternoon. And they said they had basically a mystery witness, but they didn't want to identify, and that they were acting on newly discovered information. By the evening, the news had broken that Cassidy Hutchinson would be the witness. And the indications are that they abruptly put her on, they say, because of concerns about her security. And that dovetails with, I think, what Liz Cheney said at the end of the hearing, which is which was after her testimony was concluded. So let me just cover this before we get into her testimony. At the end of the hearing, Liz Cheney said that the committee understood that a number of the witnesses it had contacted and was bringing in were being contacted by people connected to President Trump, who were basically telling them, you know, we know you're loyal. You know who's watching your testimony. As long as you stay loyal, you'll be fine. You know, that sort of intimidating thing. Again, I don't like it when the committee does stuff like that, because, you know, I think if you're going to make that kind of an allegation, you need to put a witness on. It shouldn't be somebody just like saying that. They really didn't. If Ms. Hutchinson has been the subject of that, or the object of that kind of alleged intimidation, that's not evident from her testimony. Mm-hmm. But at least the committee throws a lot of stuff out there, and they've thrown that out there as well.
So let's dive into the key elements of her testimony. So first of all, there's this matter of the rally on January 6th and the security around the rally. And there are warnings. Look, we got people in the crowd with weapons. They played a call about a guy with a gun in a tree, and Secret Service is picking up when the crowd is going through these magnometers, brass knuckles and other bear spray and other kind of weapons. And it's clear they have a lot of people who are armed and don't want to go through the so-called mags because they want to give up their weapons. And she testifies that Trump is furious that people are being kept out of the rally, when explained to him why it's really important for security reasons that the mags stay there. He says, well, they may be armed, but they're not coming to get me. They're not going to hurt me. Let them come in to the rally and then let them march on the Capitol, which seems to suggest he is fine with angry and armed people heading to the Capitol to disrupt the electoral count or make their dissatisfaction known after his speech.
Yeah, that's all right, Rich. And it really hits on the head. What I think is the most important part of her testimony, which is that it ties President Trump more tightly than has previously been understood, or at least previously alleged. I have to keep stopping myself and pointing out that she hasn't been cross-examined, that we haven't heard from other witnesses yet. But while I've heard a lot of pushback from her testimony, I've heard very minimal pushback on this element of her testimony. The most I've heard people say in the pushback is that the committee has exaggerated the firearms element of the arms that the people had at the rally that day. So we had already heard a lot of reporting that there were armed militia groups there, but they had mainly left their arms in places like Virginia, I think, you know, that they had gotten hotel rooms, and they had they were treating them like weapons depots. Like everybody was leaving their arms there with the idea that they could come back and get them if they if they needed them. So what we heard now, this, it's important to understand, this does not come from Cassidy Hutchinson. This comes from the committee, but setting the stage for her testimony, what Liz Cheney played was surveillance video that showed armed people in the trees around the mall outside the Ellipse, and audio communications traffic among the Capitol Police and the other security personnel, which indicated that they had seen people who they believed had rifles or Glocks, you know, other firearms. So the pushback I've heard on this is, you know, look, there were tens of thousands of people at this rally, and it's not to be, it wouldn't be surprising that some of them were armed, but that the committee is taking a few reports of armed people and trying to create the impression that there were thousands of people who had firearms, when in fact that may have only been, you know, fairly sparse. But I don't think anybody doubts, Rich, that there were a lot of other weapons, and there were a lot of weapons that were seized. And that, to me, I must say, as someone who has quite a bit of experience, you know, working in places where magnetometers, where you have to go through magnetometers to get in, it's really surprising to me that, like, if you had a knife or brass knuckles or something, that you would actually, I mean, the fact that they seized as much stuff as they seized indicates that people who were armed decided to try to go through the magnetometers anyway. Mm-hmm. But the what was stressed in the testimony, and more of this was disclosed by the committee than testified to by Hutchinson, but was that as bad as the inside of the Ellipse was in terms of how much stuff they had seized in the way of, you know, what you just described, you know, brass knuckles, Liz at one point referred to military grade backpacks. And I have to say, I don't know what that means, you know. But, you know, she did talk about, you know, brass knuckles and poles and you know, blunt objects, a lot of spray, which we knew about. And obviously, the security personnel were worried enough about the people who had tried to bring that stuff in, even though the magnetometers made it highly likely that it would be seen. But they were even more worried about the people, obviously, outside, because they figure those are the people who were smart enough not to come through the magnetometers. So that's the background to this exchange that they have with Trump, who is ripping angry, according to Hutchinson's testimony, and wants, as he put it, the mags taken away. Get rid of the mags. They're my people. They're not here to hurt me. Right. And he did, according to her, say they can come in, they can watch the speech, and then they can march on the Capitol. So the emphasis by the committee here is that he is very well aware that these people are armed and dangerous, and he not only wants them to come in for his speech and fire them up, but he also was saying they're going to march down to the Capitol. And they did, Rich, I think, try to make him look really small and egomaniacal, in the sense that what had him upset about the magnetometers and the fact that it thinned out the crowd. And he was worried about, as they kept saying, the shot. And what he meant by the shot is an old television expression of the camera image that would be going out to the world of his speech. He thought it was going to be too sparsely attended, and he was angry about that. So that's what the background to that was. And I guess, Rich, we should importantly say two other things about this. One is, in the days prior to January 6th, they got a lot of intelligence that things could be really bad on January 6th. There was reporting from the Secret Service, there was reporting from the FBI, there was reporting from O'Brien, who was the National Security Advisor. Hutchinson testified that O'Brien called, I think it was on January 4th, if I'm remembering this right, where he asked to talk to Mark Meadows, and Meadows wasn't there, but she suggested that he talk to Tony Ornato, who turns out to be a very important person in the story. He's the White House security director, basically. I think they call him director of operations. The other thing that Liz Cheney elicited here, Rich, to set this all up, which also turns out to be very important, I think, is on January 2nd, Hutchinson is at the White House in the evening where there's a meeting between Mark Meadows and Rudy Giuliani. And she, Hutchinson, walks Rudy out of the White House. And he says to her, are you excited about the 6th? Mm-hmm. And she said, you know, basically, this was the first time that she understood that there was going to be action on the 6th. And he said, it's going to be great. We're going to go to the Capitol. The president's going to be there. He's going to look powerful, she said. And the last thing he said is, ask the chief about it, meaning Meadows, the chief of staff. So she said she went back to Meadows' office and she found him, as he often was, sitting on the couch, you know, going through his phone.
The average work day of all of us.
What's that?
The average day of all of us.
Yes, right.
Home offices that we do, sit on the couch and scroll through our phones.
Yep. So there he is sitting on the couch scrolling through his phone. And she comes in and she said, Mark, you know, Rudy's very excited about the 6th. He said to ask you about it, what's going to happen on the 6th. And she said he was silent for a long time. And then he finally looked up and he said, Cass, which is what they called her, it could get real, real bad. And she said that was the first time that she actually was got a sense of fright about the 6th. And she said she distinctly remembered it because up until that point, she hadn't really focused much on it. But, you know, that sounded like things were going to be bad.
Yeah. And it accords with what the Steve Bannon prediction was, it the morning of or the day before, about how crazy it's going to be, like nothing we've ever seen. So going back to the mags, one, Trump was correct to be worried about the shot. I was talking to someone about this a couple of weeks ago, former Trump official, and I was saying, oh, that crowd looked to me like 5,000 or something. And he's like, no, it was huge. It stretched all along the ellipse. So I was miscued by just the people who were permitted to, or came in to see his speech. So Trump was right about that concern about the crowd size image. But so this is something she heard directly, right? Because this is one of the criticisms of her testimony, is a lot of it is secondhand. But she's saying she heard this with her own ears, Trump say it. So one, is that correct? Two, has this been suggested by, you know, there have been multiple books written about this, and a lot of reporters going through events with a fine tooth comb. Have we had any suggestion of this previously, that Trump was concerned about the mags?
I hadn't heard that before, Rich. I have heard that there was a lot of intelligence about fear of violence. Mm-hmm. And I have seen there's a published timeline from the Capitol Police, which shows that around the 3rd or 4th of January, they got some pretty serious intelligence that things could get really bad at the Capitol. You know, talking about like the possibility of the Capitol being occupied, and these groups called like the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers potentially being there. So there was a lot of intel. I think the other thing that's important about this, she mentions that she talks to Rudy on the 2nd. Liz seemed to elicit in testimony from her, and she didn't really connect this up, and the committee has suggested that this will be like the focus of the next couple of hearings they're preparing for. But she did say that when the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys came up, when they were talking about the potential and the intelligence they had about the potential for violence, she said that Rudy's name was often brought up in the same connection with these militias. Now, I thought that was very vague testimony. She didn't say that there was necessarily any connection between the two, just that Rudy came up whenever these militias came up. This is the reason that angle I think is important. In the days right prior to January 6th, Rudy and John Eastman set up a war room in the Willard Hotel, which is where they're coordinating all this stuff. I'm not saying they were coordinating the riot, to be clear. I'm saying they were coordinating the Stop the Steal rally, which is what they were mainly involved in and spoke at. The other thing, Rich, that's of some importance is on January 5th and 6th, Roger Stone and Mike Flynn, who are obviously advisors of President Trump's, but were not in the government at that time. Stone was never in the government under Trump. But they set up suites near each other with, I think, Big Common Area, also in the Willard Hotel. So all these guys are in the Willard Hotel at that time, which is close by the White House. And on Hutchinson testifies that on January 5th, Trump told Meadows to call Roger Stone and Mike Flynn. And Hutchinson testifies that she understands that he made those calls, but she doesn't know for sure that he did. And she doesn't know what they talked about, but he certainly, she believed that he did reach out to them. That I think is, the committee is going to come back to that, and it's going to be of some importance to them, because Stone was very public in saying that the Oath Keepers were in charge of his security during January 5th and January 6th. So I think this is the way the committee is going to try to tie the people around Trump to the militias, some of whom, you know, members of which have been charged with seditious conspiracy. So it looks to me like that's what's coming next.
So let's go to the speech itself at the rally, and then the controversy over going to the Capitol or not, Trump going to the Capitol or not. So a common theme in her testimony is how freaked out Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, was. And the White House counsel's office apparently was very concerned with all the fighting passages in the speech, and one of them taken out, and they weren't.
Yeah, you know, I don't know Pat Cipollone personally. I think I've met him once or twice at like Federalist Society things. I know people who do know him. He's got a very good reputation among those people. Bill Barr thinks very highly of him. I really wonder why Pat didn't just after the Ukraine impeachment, why he didn't just say, you know, job well done. I think I'm going to go back to private practice. But he hung around to the bitter end. And I guess we should be glad that he did, because even though the committee's now trying to goad him into testifying, I think Liz tweeted about it. Was it yesterday or the day before? Maybe both. But anyway, they're beating the drums for Cipollone to come in and testify. But he does emerge in the testimony as kind of the hero of the piece, where he's trying to stop them every time they look like they're doing something they shouldn't be doing. And when things start to go bad, he's the one who says we got to take action here. When Hutchinson, by contrast, portrays Meadows as kind of ineffectual and at times catatonic and overwhelmed by the situation. So Trump's speech was a presidential speech, so it was vetted like presidential speeches get vetted. And apparently Cipollone's hair was on fire over some of the stuff that the president was planning to say, and implored them to take out the more provocative stuff that was in the speech. So, you know, for example, you know, fight for me, you got to fight for your country. He thought, you know, connecting that up with the idea that they were all going to march to the Capitol was a really bad idea. I think, once again, I think this is untoward of the committee. When they present the speech, they did not present the part where Trump said that he wanted peaceful protests. Right. It's like, you know, the committee seems to think that if they don't mention that it goes away somehow.
Right.
But they, you know, and I, for the life of me, I don't understand why they continue to do that, because the more evidence we get, the more that seems to be just lip service rather than something he really meant. But you don't leave it out, you know, you just don't leave it out, and they keep leaving it out. But anyway, Cipollone was very adamant that they needed to take these fiery, provocative phrases out, and they weren't taken out, obviously.
Yeah. Okay. So now we get going to the Capitol, and Trump is adamant that he's going to the Capitol, that he wants to go to the Capitol. Cipollone famously tells Hutchison, according to your testimony, that if he goes to the Capitol, they're going to be charged with every crime imaginable. So why, just as a first part of the discussion on this particular element of it, why would it be so bad for Trump to show up at the Capitol?
With an armed mob? Gee, I don't know. Well, you know, let's just think about it for a second in a technical constitutional law sense. The president has absolutely no role in the joint session of Congress, and I think that's quite intentional. The Constitution, the statutory law that apply to this, have the vice president in his capacity as president of the Senate presiding. And the idea is that they are going to count the state certified electoral votes. So it's the vice president and Congress. The president is kept out of it. And I think it's pretty obvious why you would keep the president out of that. You know, most times the president, I'm sure the framers figured the president would frequently be someone who was contesting for the office. And, you know, while we have two plus century tradition, Rich, of peaceful transfer of power. At the time the Constitution was written and the framers' experience about the history of democracy, that was no sure thing. So I think when they design a process that keeps the president away from the count, that was intentional. That was not, you know, something that they sort of idly arrived at. And then obviously, Rich, in a separation of power sense, the reason I emphasize that the vice president is at this thing in his capacity as president of the Senate, this is a congressional proceeding. You know, the president, that's Congress. That's their branch of government. The executive has no business being in the Capitol unless he's invited by Congress, any more than you would expect Congress could just show up at the White House anytime they wanted without the executive saying, okay. So just in terms of separation of powers, Trump had no business being on Capitol Hill that day. He's got no legal reason to be involved in this. And obviously, the president, the security concerns with the president on any occasion going up to the Capitol would be intense. But in this instance, where you're talking about a rally where there were tens of thousands of people who had just been fired up, you know, even the prospect of him going up there was something that alarmed people in the days before. It wasn't just Cipollone. You know, Kevin McCarthy apparently was adamant that he was promised that Trump was not coming up to Capitol Hill and wasn't going to try to do that. So this is something that was widely discussed in the days before January 6th. As we know from if her testimony is true, you know, Rudy was telling her as early as January 2nd that he was going to the Capitol, and the committee played tape from a couple of White House aides who said that the president mentioned a number of times that he was going to the Capitol. So Trump was convinced he was going to the Capitol. And the interesting thing is she testifies, Rich, that that idea got rejected. Well, yeah, it got rejected by the underlings. Trump was never on board with the rejection of it. And I think they basically told McCarthy and other people, we're not going to let him go up there, but they didn't work out how they were going to not let him go up there. And it was pretty clear that he was going up there. Liz made a point.
He said it, right? I mean, he says it in the speech.
Well, yeah, but the thing is, before the speech, Liz said in her, in setting up some of this testimony, that Meadows wrote in his memoir about being chief of staff that Trump said he was going to the Capitol, but he only meant it rhetorically or metaphorically, he said. And she said that was a lie. And the reason she says that, among other things, is there's a lot of evidence that Trump was adamant that he was going. But also the committee has now studied records of the Secret Service and the National Security Council. The Secret Service's records show that they were trying to suddenly throw together a way for Trump to go to the Capitol from the Ellipse. And right. the National Security Council, which is monitoring this in real time, their records indicate that they assumed Trump was going to the Capitol. And the only thing was the Secret Service hadn't come up with what the best route was.
Right. Yet.
Fortunately, this guy, Bobby Engel, who was the head of Trump's security detail, was adamant that he was not going. And I think Tony Ornato also was pretty adamant that he was not going. He's the White House security chief.
So Trump, metaphorically or not, maybe it's one of these things, again, that should be taken seriously, but not literally, when he said he's going to the Capitol. He says it in the speech, and McCarthy freaks out and tries to get in touch with Meadows and gets in touch with Hutchinson. Again, this is one of the bizarre elements of her position, that since she's close to the White House chief of staff, who's close to the most powerful man on the planet, people are lobbying her, really important people are lobbying her and telling her to get messages and stop the president from doing things. But McCarthy is like, look, you guys lied to us. He said he wasn't going to come, and he's coming. Don't show up my office. And Trump gets into the SUV, and this is the most explosive and I imagine is going to be the most contentious part of her testimony. Supposedly, he gets in and is expecting to go to the Capitol. Is it Engel or Ornato who's in the car?
It's Engel. Engel is a Secret Service agent. He's the head of the detail. So Trump is in the SUV, and we'll have to get to why it's the SUV and why that's important. But Trump is in the SUV, at least with Engel and one other agent who's driving. I suspect there's probably other agents in there as well, but at least those two agents, there's testimony about them being there.
So he's, you know, they're saying, I guess Engel's saying, sir, we're taking you back to the White House. It's too dangerous. You can't go to the Capitol. He's like, I'm the effing president. We're going to the effing Capitol. And supposedly lunges towards the wheel to try to turn it towards the Capitol or whatever. And has a physical altercation with Engel. Right.
Right.
And then back at the White House, Ornato and Engel are sitting in, is it Meadows' office?
They come to Meadows' office, but they don't meet Meadows. They meet Hutchinson. Right. I don't believe Meadows is there for this first briefing.
And Ornato.
Here's what they say. She says she heard. She says when they're having the argument that you just described about Trump wanting to go to the Capitol, Trump reaches from the back seat and grabs the steering wheel. At which point, Engel, who's sitting next to Trump in the back seat, puts his hand on Trump's arm and says, Mr. President, you have to let go of the wheel. We're not going to the Capitol. We're going back to the West Wing. And at that point, Trump is incensed. So supposedly with his free hand, he lunges at the clavicle area of Engel. And it's not clear that he actually, you know, hit him or anything like that. Just a lunge. So that's what she says she heard. And of course, you're right, they do go back to the West Wing. So when they get back to the West Wing, Ornato brings Engel with him. This is Hutchinson's testimony. And they see Hutchinson in Meadows' office. I'm not sure where Meadows is at this point in time.
He's sitting catatonic somewhere, looking at his phone.
Probably going through scrolling through his phone, right? She proceeds to say that Ornato, with Engel next to him and apparently agreeing with what he's saying, narrates what happened in the car.
Right.
And we should probably quickly cover, since this is where the big pushback on her testimony is, we should cover the fact that it seems to me that the committee led Hutchinson into one problem with this testimony, which is when she's describing what happened, Liz paused her and said to her, now the car the president travels around, the limo is called the Beast, right? And the testimony, I don't remember Hutchinson saying that they were in the Beast. You know, she was asked about was, is that what the car is called? And that created the assumption that she was saying they were in the limo. The reason that's important, Rich, as I understand how this goes, is the limo is designed such that it would really not be possible as a practical matter for Trump to get his, to get, to reach all the way to the, right, to the steering wheel.
Huge vehicle.
Right. Whereas it would be possible, at least possible, with the SUV. So that's one thing that it looks, I don't think Hutchinson testified to that. I think the committee kind of led her into that.
So let me just lay my cards on the table, Andy. We were talking about this a little bit in the editor's podcast. I just don't believe the story. I believe she may have heard what she heard, or this innocent misinterpretation. But the idea that this kind of overweight 70-year-old guy, president of the United States, is lunging from the back of an SUV, which even, you know, an SUV that's not a beast, not the beast, that's a physical tat. That's a lot of distance. And you would look and feel ridiculous. I mean, you have to lay yourself all the way out. I don't think it happened. I think there might have been some argument. But I think, as you said in one of your columns about this and your experience, you know, you can have good faith witnesses that have differing accounts, and they're often understandable reasons for that. They're not, you know, they're not deliberately lying necessarily. But I think this is a game of telephone that ran out of control. That's just my gut instinct.
I think, Rich, not only is that true, I think that the facts are starting to unfold in a way that's supporting what you're theorizing here. And I also could see easily, like, in the frantic craze of that day, you know, a description being given to her where they said, you know, he was batshit that they wanted to that they wouldn't take him to the Capitol, and you know, he got crazy in there, and we thought he was going to grab the wheel. You know, you mm-hmm. can see somebody like popping off like that, and then the next thing in a telephone tag kind of thing, that becomes he grabbed the wheel, right? So right. Who knows what really happened? But here's what. Well, we should talk about who knows what really happened, which is Ornato and yeah. this agent Bobby Engel. So after the testimony, there is reporting that, you know, number one, Secret Service says the committee never reached out to them in the days before Hutchinson testified. So they didn't try to, this is something that she admits, Rich, that she did not see. She was told
right.
about.
Right.
So you would think that before they elicited this, since it's such an explosive allegation, they would get their ducks in a row. Evidently the committee never called Secret Service to ask to talk to people to see if this actually happened. And that's important, Rich, because both Engel and Ornato have been interviewed by the committee.
Right.
So, you know, that raises the possibility, which I can't believe Liz and the people who are working with her would do this. So I'm assuming that they didn't give testimony that was inconsistent with what she said. I'm assuming that they just didn't get asked about this subject. But even if that's how it happened, they should have gone back to them before yeah. they elicited this testimony publicly, obviously. Secondly, Engel says he is, according to the reports, now this is reports that first came out of NBC, but they've been repeated elsewhere by other people, that both Engel and the driver, who has not been identified, the Secret Service agent who was driving the SUV, are not only prepared, they are eager to testify under oath that this did not happen, that Trump never put his hand on the wheel, that Engel never put his hand on Trump. These things didn't happen. More problematic, I've said that I don't think that is a terrible blow to Hutchinson's testimony. Now, it's publicly, it's bad, because this was the most explosive allegation. But if you look at her testimony, she never said she saw this. She said it was told to her. So I don't think that blows her out of the water. Here's what could blow her out of the water. Ornato, this is based on a report from Fox News, Ornato watched her testimony and told, and someone who is described by Fox News as close to Ornato says that he was shocked by Cass's testimony. And that he has already himself testified before the deposed by the committee. Again, we don't know if he was asked about this or not, but what he says is he never told her that this happened. Now, it's one thing for her to get wrong something because she was misinformed. It's right. quite a different thing for her to say that she was told something that she may not have been told. So, and by the way, I should underscore here, the fact that Ornato, even if he comes in and testifies that he never told her, that would be very important. It wouldn't necessarily mean he's right. You know, he's telling the truth and she's lying, or that anybody's lying. Who knows? We'll have to hear the testimony, but we haven't heard it. And I should just point out, Rich, that, you know, the reason you do investigations in secret, in part, is because a lot of things come up that are explosive and inconsistent. And before you can charge anyone, you're supposed to figure out what happened. Like, you're supposed to have a coherent theory of why there are inconsistencies and what the actual truth is. So I think it's really bad that they're doing this like in real time. And it sounds like they were so hot to get this information about Trump out to the public that they didn't do their due diligence before putting her on the stand, which is not her fault, by the way. She could, this is why when I was a prosecutor, and any prosecutor would tell you this, your nightmare is Congress. When they get involved in something, when they get interested in something, when they wanted to have your witnesses for their hearings before your witnesses have testified, they kill witnesses because they don't know what, well, I don't want to say that, but they kill witnesses because this isn't their line of work.
Right.
You know, building cases is hard. It's a full-time job. It takes lots and lots of hours beyond a full-time job. And if all you're doing is that, things still go wrong in trials. So it's not something that you can do in your spare time. And it looks to me like they put this witness on without doing everything they should have done. And it may be that you have somebody who's trying to tell the truth and is being undone by the way she's being presented. But it looks like if the reporting is to be believed, Ornato, Engel, and the driver are all ready to testify that what she said isn't true. And Ornato is ready to testify that he never told her that.
Yeah. So in the world of journalism, this is known as too good to check. And just lunging towards the steering wheel is just too juicy to check. But it's also, it's totally unnecessary to the main points the committee is trying to hit. And if they have exposed her where she is, you know, innocently got this wrong, and they walked her into this trap that's going to be used to undermine her credibility. And I take your point about the distinction between, you know, misunderstanding something she was told and, you know, and testifying to something that just totally didn't happen and that she wasn't told. But it doesn't matter, really. It's for any persuadables, it's really going to hurt her credibility. So this will have been a totally necessary, you know, own goal on the part of the committee if it's so. So let's move.
Rich, can I just stop you for 1 second? Because we should probably cover this as long as we just covered that.
Yep.
Here's the other major pushback, because this is, I think, where we're going anyway. While the riot is going on and all this dysfunction is happening behind the scenes in the West Wing, they start to talk about trying to get Trump to make a statement. And what ends up happening is there's a circle of people. Hutchinson says she's in it. Mark Meadows, Eric Hirschman from the White House counsel's office. I believe Pat Cipollone as well, according to her testimony. But anyway, with Matthews dictating, Liz elicits from Hutchinson that she wrote down anybody who's illegally in the Capitol has to leave. And that Hirschman, because he thought that was too narrow, suggested adding anyone who's in the Capitol or is there without proper authorization has to leave. So there's a small notepad. I think it's Mark Meadows' stationery, but it's from a notepad. And Liz elicits from Hutchinson that Hutchinson wrote that note in her handwriting. She says, "I recognize my handwriting," dictated by Meadows. After the testimony is over, Eric Hirschman, through a spokesman, says, "I am the one who wrote the note. Not only did I write the note, when I was deposed by the committee, I told them I wrote the note. I've testified that I wrote the note." Now, I would have thought, Rich, that this was like Much Ado About Nothing, because there's no doubt that, like, you know, if you put everybody's testimony together, it sounds like, you know, they were together. This note got written. Hirschman made a suggestion that got incorporated in the note. Who the hell cares who wrote the note? But obviously, again, you know, if she identified her own handwriting and said that she had a specific memory of writing this note, and then it turns out she didn't, and we don't know again, right? But that would be really bad, because that would be, again, that's her personal recollection and she identifies her handwriting. And I have to say, again, it's not that important, because it turns out Trump didn't give the statement anyway.
Right.
So why you would want to, like, make a big deal out of this, I don't know. But it, again, it looks like she's been steered into an error. Now, it could be that she just steered them into the error. Maybe she, her testimony was so adamant about this that they were sure, or they thought they were sure. But if they had information that Hirschman said he had written this, it's hard to understand why they would go there, you know, because it's not important who wrote it.
It's hard to fathom misidentifying your own handwriting.
Right. That
was very weird.
Yep.
I just know if it was illegible, I'll say, okay, that's mine.
Yeah. Well, but you know, the funny thing, Rich, is in court, that would not be admissible evidence, more than likely, because what would happen is you would ask people what happened at the meeting, and they'd say, oh, we decided, like, he should make a statement that would say the following. And you could use the note to refresh a person's recollection if they couldn't remember, but the note itself would not go into evidence, because that's not the important thing. The testimony is what's important. So they've made a big to-do over something that probably wouldn't even be admissible evidence in the trial. And she now walked into the possibility that she, you know, she's identified her own handwriting, and you got somebody. Hirschman is not just anybody. Hirschman is a very credible witness that they've relied on for a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've seen him again and again come up in these hearings because he's given what appears to be pretty forthright and at times very colorful testimony. So this is not like somebody who's like some Trumpy who's looking to undermine her testimony. You know, this is someone they've actually relied on.
Yeah. Okay. So let's take it back. We have the lunging, supposedly, and Trump's back at the White House, and he's supposedly furious at Mark Meadows. Mark, I was supposed to be going to the Capitol, who's done this dirty deed against me. Meadows is in his usual catatonic state. Cipollone's hair's on fire as usual. Cipollone's rushing into Meadows' offices. Mark, we got to get the president to say something to call off the dogs who are breaking into the Capitol as we speak, or there's going to be blood on our hands. And Meadows and Cipollone, by her account, go and talk to the president and come back frustrated, having made no progress.
Yeah. Now, she sees some of this, Rich, and probably enough of it that if it happens, she could give pretty admissible testimony on this. What she says is that Meadows seemed to be like paralyzed, that he was almost, catatonic, overwhelmed by the moment. So she's trying to snap him out of it. And one of the ways she tries to snap him out of it is say, have you heard from Jim? Meaning his friend, Jim Jordan. Meadows and Jordan are famously close. So she says that did seem to get his wheels turning again. Because she said to him, have you heard from Jim? He could be in there. The rioters could get in there. And they started to talk about that when Cipollone comes racing down the hall and basically says, Mark, what's the president doing? And she says, he doesn't want to be interrupted. He doesn't want and
be alone right now.
Cipollone basically says, are you crazy? Like, the rioters, they've arrived at the Capitol. They're sieging the Capitol. So Cipollone kind of forces Meadows to go see Trump, and they go down to the dining room. And in the meantime, I think Hutchinson made some effort to reach out to Jordan, and the phone rings and it's Jordan. So now Hutchinson didn't go with Cipollone and Meadows to the dining room. But when Jordan calls, she goes down to the dining room off the Oval Office and confirms with the usher that Meadows is in the dining room with the president. So she opens the door and she sees Meadows there. Cipollone is there. Trump is there. She's not seeing everything, but she's here. It's obviously a very tense conversation. And over the phone, which she's trying to give to Meadows, she can hear the hang Mike Pence chants, according to the testimony. And then she gives the phone to Meadows and she basically gets out of there and leaves the three of them there with the phone. So you're right. Then they, what ends up happening is a few minutes later. Now the importance here, Rich, is she timestamped this around sometime between 2:15 and 2:25 in the afternoon. And they come back, Cipollone, Meadows, and she said, I believe that Eric Hirschman was with them by that point. And they come back dejectedly to the office. And Cipollone said, Mark, we have to do something. They're talking about hanging the effing vice president. And Meadows replies, Pat, you heard him. He doesn't want to do anything. He thinks Mike is wrong and they're right, meaning that Pence is the one who betrayed him and that the rioters are actually in the right. So Cipollone is saying we have to do something. We have to do something. But, you know, Trump is resistant to doing anything. And the reason the timestamp is important is at 2:24 is when Trump issues his tweet that says basically that, you know, they were sunk in the January 6th joint session of Congress because Mike Pence didn't have the courage to do what was needed to be done, that he, you know, he wouldn't refuse to count the votes. He wouldn't send the vote back to the states. But it's at that point that he puts out, while the idea of the testimony is, while the hang Mike Pence cheers are ringing in everyone's ears, it's at that moment that Trump decides to put this tweet out. And the point being, obviously, that it increased the danger that that Pence was in. Now, I think the pushback you're going to hear on this is that Trump may have known, maybe from Tommy Tuberville, the senator, that Pence had already been moved and he was in a different area. If that's what they're going to push back, good luck with that. But if her testimony is accurate about that, it's really obviously bad.
Yeah, obviously, it didn't mean it literally that Mike Pence should be
like metaphorically.
So then we get, and it's sort of shocking when you do kind of the minute by minute how late this Trump video comes. 4:17 p.m. You finally
4:17
this grudging video, and everyone had been lobbying him. Look, again, you have to call off the dialogue, call for peace. This is destroying everything we've built. Various allies, media allies like Sean Hannity weighing in, and Trump makes this statement under duress, and it's still a statement that is really appalling, right? I mean, praising these people and saying how full of love they are, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, it's there's a kind of a fall off in the narrative, Rich, you know, from the time of the tweet until he finally does the statement. But if you think about it, it's, you know, that's from 2:25 to 4:17. So it's almost 2 full hours. And basically what it sounds like it was filled with, if this testimony is accurate, is desperate attempts to try to get Trump to say something publicly to get these people to stand down. And it wasn't just like the outside advisors, as you mentioned, but also Ivanka Trump apparently was pleading with him to do it. And he wouldn't. He was just very resistant to do it. They're not able to get him to put the statement out until 4:17. And as you say, the statement is appalling and it doesn't really say what they wanted him to say. He wouldn't condemn, you know, far from condemning what they did. He did say, we have to have peace. We have to.
Right.
After hours of rioting, we have to have peace. But that was, you know, basically she says, by the way, that she was not involved in the speech. she knew about it, like everybody knew about it, but she didn't have any role in, you know, what he ultimately said and how that was done and how it was recorded and how it was put out. She just learned about it.
And then as we begin to land this plane with regard to this testimony, you get the January 7th speech where, again, there's contention over this. And apparently Trump wanted to float the idea that he would pardon rioters.
Yes. So he gives a speech on January 7th. They say he's very reluctant to give it, just like he was the day before. But the difference now is he's told, apparently by Cipollone, but probably by others as well, that there's now serious talk of invoking the 25th Amendment. And that, according to the testimony, is what basically convinces him that he better give the speech. So they want him to say the election is over now, and he won't say that. And what he wanted to do was float the possibility of pardons, and Cipollone and Hirschman apparently, you know, adamantly argued with him that that would be a disastrous thing for him to do, and he didn't. But he wouldn't say that the election is over, although I think that is the speech where he committed to the transition finally. But again, what they basically say is he resisted doing it and probably did it mainly because he was concerned at that point that the 25th Amendment talk was serious.
Yeah. And then what is the significance at the end of her testimony? She says that Rudy and Meadows were interested in pardons.
Yeah, well, I think this follows on, Rich, what we talked about in the last podcast about, remember, we had one hearing that was about members of Congress. The at the tail end of the committee that was the hearing that was about the Justice Department, Adam Kinzinger went into congressional Republicans who had sought pardons from Trump, according to the allegation that the committee is making. And what Kinzinger said, and I think we may have talked about this already because I thought it was really a misleading statement. What Kinzinger said at the end was, I can't think of any reason anybody would look for a pardon unless they knew they had committed a crime. And, you know, what we, I think, discussed the last time was, you know, you could obviously understand someone seeking a pardon, even if they didn't think they committed a crime, if they thought the next people who were coming into power in 2 weeks were going to make it look like they committed a crime or treat them like they had committed a crime. But I think this, the reason I mention all that is this is along the line of the committee's theme that if you ask for a pardon, that shows consciousness of guilt that you've committed a crime. So I think they wanted to land with a thud at the end with this idea that both Rudy and Meadows, the way they would say it, believe they had committed a crime, because why else would they ask Trump for pardons? And we should stress that for all this talk about pardons, 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 Trump didn't give any.
Right. So takeaways here, let's do the moral plane and the legal plane. So morally, you know, the controversy about her testimony aside, just in broad gauge, it at the very least, underlines the reckless disregard that was present with Trump here, whether the rational, responsible reaction of anyone would be, okay, there's a crowd that might be heading to the Capitol and it has arms and it's angry. Let's make sure that crowd doesn't show up at the Capitol. Let's do everything possible to calm that crowd down. Let's do everything possible to warn Congress, make sure the security is sufficient. Instead, you have Trump, apparently, you know, he didn't ever say, according to this testimony, oh gosh, weapons, that's terrible. He resists every effort to get them to stand down or at least to use less incendiary rhetoric. So if it's not a direct incitement, again, not using the legal term, at the very least, it's incredibly reckless.
Yeah, I think that's right, Rich. And in terms of the power of it, I'm going to invoke something you say all the time. So this isn't a we, Rich, this is the you. But you've pointed out any number of times that it's one thing to hear a story, but then when you see a video or you see an image, it changes everything, even though it doesn't really necessarily alter your logical understanding of what happened, but it changes your perception. Well, this isn't exactly the same thing quite as seeing a video of all this, but you know, for a long time before Hutchinson testified, we've speculated about what must have been going on in the White House. And we've heard like bits and pieces of it, but no one who was there ever tried to provide a minute by minute narrative of what actually was going on. I mean, we didn't get into, you know, Liz, I think for atmospheric purposes, elicited from Hutchinson that, you know, Trump was prone to meteoric flights of temper, that like when he heard that Bill Barr had told the AP that there wasn't actionable fraud in connection with the election, that he hurled his lunch against a wall. Hutchinson said that wasn't just something that she had heard. She came in and the porter was cleaning up the mess and she actually helped him wipe ketchup off the wall. And Liz then elicited from her that on other occasions, Trump had done similar things, and that a couple of times he had just grabbed the tablecloth and thrown it over. I think these things are brought out because we don't have video of what went on, but these are powerful images. They make a difference to people, even if they don't much advance the narrative of what happened on January 6th. And I do think, in terms of the moral point, having the curtain peeled back, even if it's just by oral description as opposed to videos of what actually happened minute by minute from somebody who's there, does change your opinion, or not change your opinion, but it alters your perception of the power of all this. I mean, we've said any number of times, I mean, Trump was in the White House for 3 hours plus while this was all going on. This couldn't have been good. You know, no, whatever our wildest imaginings about it were, it couldn't have been good. But now, you know, someone's come in and described it, and it really isn't good.
And then how much does it matter legally in terms of the case they might be building against Trump?
Well, I think the first thing we should acknowledge is that they are trying to build a case against Trump. I mean, what would have been actually, Rich, the big story that we'd have been talking about if she hadn't testified, I think, is the fact that the FBI executed search warrants at the home of Jeffrey Clark, who is the Justice Department lawyer that we talked about a week ago, who Trump kind of drafted into his effort to use the Justice Department to try to tell the states that there really was fraud in the election. So 17 months after the fact, they go to, at 7 o'clock in the morning, they show up at Clark's home, spend three and a half hours tossing his residence, and apparently took all of his, by his account at least, took all of his communications devices. And he made the beeline to Tucker's show. I think this seems to be what the pattern is. You know, it happens and then they go on Tucker's show. So Tucker had him on last week. And then the same day that happened, I believe this is the day before Hutchinson testified that these searches happened. But they also approach John Eastman as he's coming out of a restaurant in New Mexico, and they have a search warrant, and they take his cell phone. Now, taking lawyers' cell phones is obviously a big deal because you got a lot of client communications on there, presumably. But I think the big deal here, Rich, is they did this by search warrant, which means the Justice Department went to the court and gave probable cause that there's some crime. And they're obviously, you know, the shift of their investigation has moved from the rioters to the people around Trump, undoubtedly. They're going to court and getting probable cause warrants. Now, I think they're doing this by a little subterfuge, because they're describing the Jeffrey Clark investigation as an inspector general, a Justice Department inspector general investigation, because he's a former DOJ employee, even though he hasn't been at the DOJ in almost 2 years. And if Eastman is being investigated in connection with an IG investigation of Clark, Eastman has never been a Justice Department lawyer. I mean, not at any time. I think he clerked on the Supreme Court, and he clerked for as we discussed Mike Ludig when he was on the Court of Appeals, but I don't believe Eastman ever worked for the Justice Department. If he did, it hasn't been for years. He's been an academic for a million years. So I don't believe that this is an IG investigation. I don't doubt that they're using the resources of the IG, but if they're investigating people around Trump, it's not because they're interested in people around Trump. Mm-hmm. There's obviously a Trump investigation. And I think where this testimony, if it's credible, advances the ball, is it puts Trump much more actionably close to violence and to the understanding of violence. And I think, Rich, I guess this is the last thing I'd say about it. I think we've been talking about the wrong statute. You know, we've talked a lot about incitement and how difficult it is to prove incitement. And the thing with incitement is it criminalizes the actual words that somebody uses. That's not usually the way that prosecutors use incriminating words. It's not the words themselves are crimes, as it is with incitement. The words themselves are evidence of other crimes. They show intent, they show planning, they show that sort of thing. So there's a federal statute basically called assault on a federal officer, but it captures more than assault. It also captures intimidation. It's important to note that under the definition of assault, under federal law, just like state law, you don't actually have to hit somebody to assault them. You only have to put them in imminent fear of physical peril. My first trial by myself as a young prosecutor was assault on a federal officer, where a guy clenched his fist and the officer flinched, and that was the assault. No contact. So you don't have to show that violence actually happened, just that you put people in imminent fear of harm. And I would point out that with respect to every federal crime, there is always available an aiding and abetting theory. And under federal law, the aider and abettor is equally as guilty as the principal, as the person who actually carries out the crime. So I think it's very likely here that they're building a case that Trump aided and abetted assaults on federal officials. Under that statute, it's not just federal officers like the Capitol Police. Congress, members of Congress and the vice president are covered people under that statute. So if your legal theory is that there were armed people who the idea was to have them intimidate Congress into not doing the count that the law requires, you could charge them both with the intimidation statute, that is the assault statute, and you could also charge them with corruptly obstructing a congressional proceeding. And here, the theory would not be the cockamamie theory of, John Eastman has a frivolous legal theory, so let's try to turn that into a crime. This would be really, Rich, not much different than what the rioters have been charged with. Basically, it would be that they intimidated Congress, that it was that they were using the threat of force in order to try to influence the way they voted and counted the votes on January 6th.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Have a great 4th. And thank you, Andy McCarthy.
Thanks, Rich. Happy 4th.